And it is my privilege and pleasure once again to present Martin A. Lee, the author of the vitally important recent book, The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown Books. Martin, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks very much, David.
As we speak on November 9th of 1997, it's actually sort of a propitious anniversary. I had forgotten that this was the anniversary of Das Kristallnacht, or De-Kristallnacht, rather. And recently in the paper, and again citing the present time as November of 1997 for people who eventually hear this on tape, there have been a number of articles in the newspaper, including one, as I reach over here, one from the New York Times of last Wednesday, November 5th, talking about disturbing signs of Nazism and racism, etc., in the German army. And one of the things that impressed itself on me in reading this article is that in light of some of the information presented in your book, this should not come as all that much of a surprise.
No, it didn't come as a surprise to me, this idea that there's extreme right tendencies or currents percolating within the German army. It shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who's been watching the situation in Germany. Nazism was never really wiped away completely in Germany. And we all know from your program and other sources, David, that Nazis was resurrected, returned to power in West Germany once it became a sovereign state. And that includes within the West Germany army. There were many generals and officials, high-ranking officers from the Hitler era that retained their stripes, so to speak, and were allowed to assume their positions of rank within the West German army. And I think while they weren't flaunting any kind of affiliation for Nazism in the early Cold War period, because that was verboten, as it were, I think this set the stage in the wrong way and sort of set the seal for a certain permissiveness toward extreme nationalism within the German army that expresses itself in many ways, including these latest rounds of incidents where overt anti-Semitic acts were practiced by German troops and were filmed for some reason, whatever reason, and now they're made public and accessible by the media.
There's also discussion of Mein Kampf being available to German army units. One of the people you write about in that context is a fellow named Eberhard Taubert.
Yes, Eberhard Taubert, his story after World War II is quite illustrative. When you go back to the Hitler era, Eberhard Taubert was a judge in the so-called People's Courts. He was one of the hanging judges that were, along with his colleagues, sentencing people to death for doing things like telling an anti-Hitler joke or sleeping with a Jewish person, having sexual relations with a Jew. That would qualify a person, according to the Hitler's justice, for being put to death. Well, Eberhard Taubert also wrote the script for a propagandistic movie, a very anti-Semitic movie called The Eternal Jew, in which Jews were compared to rats and vermin and the like. And those who were watching the film were warned that Jews were really basically out to get them and their families and their life-saving, et cetera, et cetera. After World War II, rather than being brought to trial and put to justice, Eberhard Taubert ended up working for the West German Army in their psychological warfare division, and he later became a legal advisor to a man named Fritz Ries, who was a wealthy German industrialist who made a killing, literally, or a small fortune from expropriation of, or the Aryanization of, Jewish properties during Hitler's Reich. And later on, it turns out that Fritz Ries emerges as a mentor, a political mentor, to none other than Helmut Kohl, the current Chancellor of Germany, whom Kohl awarded, this is to Fritz Ries now, the Federal Cross of Merit, the highest civilian award for the West German state, was given to this person who's very tainted by the Nazi era. By saying all this, I want to stress, David, that I'm not suggesting that Helmut Kohl is a Nazi or that he's even a Nazi sympathizer, but it really underscores the extent to which in Germany, if you're in a position of power, if you're close to power, it's really less than 6 degrees separation to the Hitler era and directly back to Hitler's inner circle. In the case of Kohl and Fritz Ries and Taubert, who ultimately worked for Goebbels back in World War II, it's really only 4 degrees of separation. And we should try to keep this in perspective, what it means. Again, I don't think it means that closet Nazis are running the German state today, but it does mean that there are many of the rulers of Germany today are tainted with a very unsavory association with the past.
There, is, by the way, one of the themes that I was hoping bring up from time to time during the course of this discussion is perceived discontinuity. I think one of the problems that people have when they study the history of fascism and its operations is that the historical and journalistic record, and perhaps to a certain extent the psychological record, is such that we are presented with the notion that there were these things, the Nazis or the Italian fascists, or that somehow these things were long ago, far away, and discontinuous with society. That's not to say they're coterminous, but when we examine something like the reemergence of Nazism in the German army, the reinstitution of Nazi elements in West Germany, or the profoundly sympathetic elements in the West, industrialists, financiers, eugenicists, who thought that Hitler was just dandy for a variety of different reasons, I think it's important to understand that those discontinuities are, to a certain extent, artificial and invalid.
Yes, we agree, but then again, we don't want to go, you know, overboard in the opposite direction and attribute causality between something 50 years ago and today, when I think perhaps thinking more in terms of a lineage would be perhaps safer and a better picture.
I think it's a good observation.
Yes. I mean, obviously, if Nazis are resurrected and allowed to return to power, people who had faithfully served Hitler are allowed to return to power when West Germany becomes a country during World War II, during the Cold War, that will affect things, that will cast a shadow, that will color the environment, and certainly will. I think you can rightly speak of causality in some sense, but not in the sense of everything that happens thereafter is because. It's more like a mood, a tolerance, a willingness to turn and avert one's eyes and allow certain things to happen. And it's really a continuity of denial more than anything else.
I would, a couple of words in that regard that I would introduce. One would be networking, and another term would be bureaucratic inertia. If you appoint somebody like Eberhard Taubert to the psychological division of the Army, that necessarily is going to affect the character of that institution in terms of the people who move up following the Eberhard Tauberts.
Yes, certainly those who are going to be promoted, who are going to accept the baton and move forward, particularly when you get later into the Cold War, into the 1960s, early 70s, we're not talking about Third Reich veterans, you know, in that, as the years go on, given the fact that they're aging, they're not going to be keeping positions of power in the military, they will retire and so forth. But those who are chosen to be promoted, those who are able to get ahead within this system, will be those who can adapt and find themselves working in a congenial environment in terms of their own political views in an institution that has been affected profoundly by the fact that this restoration occurred.
One of the sources you cite, I don't know if they're off the top of my head, if the author's name is Peter Arno or one of the other writers, but one of the people you reference says that he finds the prospect of fascism being perpetuated within a democracy more frightening than fascism as opposed to democracy, which I think touches on some of the dynamics that we're addressing.
Yes, that's Theodor Adorno that you're referring to. It's a very famous quote of his. And he was one of the philosophers of the Frankfurt School, dissidents within Germany, many of whom fled, and who were critiquing partially from a Marxist, partially from an independent perspective, society and culture in Germany and the West, not only before Hitler but afterwards. And I think his statement is very interesting and very germane and relevant today for two reasons. When you talk about National Socialism against democracy, as he did, as being actually less dangerous than National Socialism within democracy, you can point toward what I see as a major split in the post-war fascist milieu today, a post-Cold War fascist milieu. You can point to the obvious Nazis who wear the swastika on the sleeve, you know, the skinheads, they shave their head, they go around threatening people, beating people up, and so forth and so on. You know, that's the National Socialism against democracy. But when you take the swastika off the sleeve, like David Duke did, and you begin to mainstream your rhetoric to the point where you sound pretty much like a mainstream Republican, or maybe even a Democrat, the kind of things that Duke was saying earlier this decade when he was running for electoral office in Louisiana.
With the endorsement of the Christian Coalition.
Yes, with the endorsement of the Christian Coalition. In fact, he was just elected Duke a few weeks ago as the head of a parish in a GOP parish in Louisiana. So he's head of a little committee within that represents a small part of the GOP within Louisiana. Nonetheless, the fact that he could be elected to that position, however inconsequential it might be in terms of the grand scheme of even state politics or federal politics, the fact that Duke is able to win favor and curry favor among mainstream Republicans is quite striking, and it illustrates what Adorno was talking about, because that's National Socialism within democracy. And what has Duke been doing more recently? He's actually been going around and giving speeches at events hosted by the National Alliance, it's a neo-Nazi group in the United States, whose leader, William Pierce, wrote the Turner Diaries, the novel that helped inspire Timothy McVeigh to bomb the federal building. So that's really Duke back where he belongs. But in my opinion, I would agree with Adorno, National Socialism within democracy is a much more serious threat.
There is a quote in one of the marvelous sources that you utilize, Martin, for your book, the book The New Reich by Michael Schmidt.
Yes.
I don't know whether it's the actual end of the formal text itself or the end of the epilogue, but he has a really relevant and I think very articulate and moving passage in which he points out, and this addresses the substance of what we're kicking around here, that the ascent of fascism necessarily entails the collaboration of, quote, respectable, unquote, judges and, quote, respectable, unquote, politicians and, quote, respectable, unquote, industrialists and, quote, respectable, unquote, financiers with the supposedly unrespectable fascists. And it is that, I would call it perhaps, maybe you would disagree, an artificial discontinuity that I think tends to blind our perceptions. And again, it's not that they're necessarily Nazis, but rather like in the movie Cabaret, where the one fellow says, well, you know, we'll control the Nazis to control, we'll use the Nazis to control the communists, and then we'll control them.
Well, certainly historically, that's exactly how things played out, as you said. And industrialists and even the German military officials thought that they could control Hitler, and it was certainly not that simple. But when we think of the situation today, where mainstream politicians and journalists and other people in society are sort of bending over backwards to play to their right, adopting the rhetoric of the far right in Germany, as politicians are today, in order to thwart the potential rise to power of groups like the Republikaner or of the Deutsche Volksunion, who tend to still remain rather marginalized comparatively, or none of these neo-fascist parties are breaking the 5% barrier in Germany, largely because their issues and their rhetoric have been largely appropriated by the conservative political party, the Christian Democratic Union, led by Kohl. But again, it's a question of how we understand that. I don't interpret that or analyze that to mean that Kohl himself is a fascist. I see Kohl as a person who lacks civic courage, and in that respect, German politicians are not very much different from politicians in the United States. Certainly Germany doesn't have a monopoly on the lack of civic coverage when you get to the high precincts of power. You know, but it is extremely irresponsible for German conservatives or even social democrats, as occasionally the case may be, to bend to the far right in order to prevent their own political parties from losing voters to these parties. It really legitimizes the kind of rhetoric that young neo-Nazis espouse. When you find, as happened recently in Germany, that the mayor of Munich was marching shoulder to shoulder with young neo-Nazis in the streets of Munich, the mayor is a member of the Christian Social Union, the conservative partner of the Christian Democratic Union. I really like the CDU's chapter in Bavaria. You can sort of pigeonhole it and say it that way. But they were marching against an exhibit, a museum exhibit that showed the extent to which the Wehrmacht, the German army, was involved in atrocities during World War II. And it had been a myth promoted after World War II, in part by the U.S. government, that really was the Nazi SS that was involved in the atrocities, and the German army was somehow exempt or above it all, or wasn't implicated in these things. And this museum exhibit really showed very convincingly that that was not the case. But a lot of people in Germany don't want to hear that. Some are willing to accept it, certainly, and some aren't, including people in high-ranking positions of power, such as the mayor of Munich. And again, that's where you have a kind of, I wouldn't say exactly a repeat of the past, but an example where conservatives are willing to, again, I don't want to use the word kowtow, but we're willing in some sense to legitimize right-wing extremists and neo-Nazis in their country when they see it as serving their own ends.
One of the people centrally involved in the Wehrmacht role in the atrocities of World War II, and another of the people you write about in your book, is Adolf Heusinger.
Yes, I mean, he's very interesting because he becomes really the leader of the German military after World War II. He was actually in the room when Hitler was giving his speech in July of 1944 and the bomb went off and nearly killed him. Adolf Heusinger was one of the people in the room with him that day, one of the high-ranking officers that were giving advice to Hitler at that very moment. And later on, in fact, he received an award of merit from the West German, or actually from Hitler, for having survived this attack. And yet his career is allowed to thrive and prosper after World War II. He becomes the leading military strategist in Bonn during the early years of the Cold War. He actually also serves in a very high position within NATO eventually. Mm-hmm. So he is an example of a high-ranking military officer from the Hitler years in Germany who was allowed to creep back into power and who had a very comfortable life for himself as a result.
He was actually head of the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, the German military high command, then became inspector general of the German armed forces, as you write, the equivalent of our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and finally chairman of the NATO Permanent Military Committee, the highest-ranking military post of NATO.
Yes.
Another of the people that you write about, and someone who is now, I believe, the equivalent of defense, Secretary of Defense in Germany, a fellow named Klaus Naumann, who has defined a much more aggressive role for the German army under with the reunited Germany in the new Europe.
Yes, it's interesting. He is, for all intents and purposes, the leader of the reunified Germany's military, General Klaus Naumann. And he's been described by Die Zeit, a very well-respected publication, a newspaper in Germany, as someone who has the stuff of fanaticism, quote-unquote. And is somewhat of an ambiguous figure, Naumann is. On the one hand, he has gone to Israel, and he has bowed his head respectfully at the Yad Vashem Memorial in Jerusalem, which is a memorial for the Holocaust and Holocaust victims. And he will do these things, and I don't even want to question his sincerity in that regard. Just let's assume he's being sincere when he does that. And yet he comes back to Germany, and then he starts talking as if he's taking words right out of Goebbels' mouth, saying how the end of the Cold War marks not the end of the period that began in 1945 when Germany lost the war, but it goes back to the days of the French Revolution, 1789, and that's the period it marks an end of, which has actually kind of chilling implications. It's because, of course, democratic forms of government emerged from the French Revolution, that they flow from that tradition. So it's really, in a sense, rebuking those traditions of liberty, equality, fraternity that at least the best of the French Revolution stood for. So, you know, Naumann speaks in some sense from both sides of his mouth. But within his military today, you'll find people closely associated with the neo-fascist Republikaner Party writing for German military journals. You know, that's also in itself disturbing, given the fact that the leader of the Republikaners, at least until recently the leader, Franz Schönhuber, has said things like Germany's only crime was to lose World War II, essentially. I'm paraphrasing the quote. I mean, that's the only thing that Germany did wrong, is lose the war.
And he had a background in the Waffen-SS.
Yes, of course. And the fact that then people who are directly identified with this political party should be writing for German military journals and teaching in German military academies and helping to train German military conscripts explains in part, I think, why the kind of extreme right-wing incidents and neo-Nazi incidents that came to recently light in newspapers are continuing to persist. Because when you got people like this guy Villnow, who I was just referring to, from the Republican Party, doing the teaching, then it's small wonder that neo-Nazism should find a niche within the German military.
We've spoken many times in the past about the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, Martin, something which was to a certain extent an outgrowth of the Gehlen Western Military and Intelligence Alliance, something that we have not spoken about in some of our past discussions except in passing, and that is some of the many manifestations of Operation Stay Behind. Could you tell us a little about that?
That's actually a very, very interesting subject that one can spend a long time talking about. I actually had written quite a bit about that, but because of editing considerations, I had to keep some of it out of the book. Operation Stay Behind, or what we know about is the Stay Behind operation, was first exposed in Italy. See, what it was really was an operation put in motion by the CIA during the Cold War. Relatively early speaking now, 49, 50, 51 is when it first starts. And the CIA had this idea that it was important to have ready and waiting in different countries in Western Europe a group of people who were trained in paramilitary exercises and techniques who would be willing, if in the event of a Soviet invasion, to surface after the invasion. They would, quote-unquote, stay behind the enemy lines in the areas now occupied by the Soviet Union. This is, of course, all theoretical. And then they would be activated. These stay-behind units would be brought alive to engage in sabotage and operations against the Soviet occupation forces.
Well, this would also apply in the event of a democratic takeover of a Western European country.
Well, this was, of course, the ostensible purpose that I just described. This was the official purpose. But in many different countries, what we find is that the stay-behind forces that were trained and set up by the CIA in conjunction with the police and secret services and military of the specific countries like Italy and Germany and West Germany and elsewhere, that these units ended up actually having another purpose, which they pursued, and that was to intervene in the event of a domestic disturbances. If things went awry as far as the U.S. was concerned, if it looked like leftists would come to power in Italy, for example, where there was a strong communist party, in order to prevent that from happening, it seems that these stay-behind units were used to intervene in these countries. And there are several examples, both in Turkey and Italy, most notably, where certain personnel associated with these stay-behind units do seem to figure in acts of terrorism and acts of political intervention that had nothing whatsoever to do with stopping or thwarting a Soviet occupation or invasion, but everything to do with manipulating the domestic political situation so that the United States could achieve a covert political objective that it sought.
You write of the strategy of tension in Italy and also of some of the Grey Wolf-connected activities in Turkey.
Well, the Grey Wolves in Turkey is quite interesting because the Grey Wolves, which is a Turkish neo-Nazi group whose most famous member, Mehmet Ali Agca, shot Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. That's how a lot of people first heard about the Grey Wolves. But the Grey Wolves were linked to a unit within the Turkish military called the Contra Guerrilla Unit, which was sort of spun out of a Turkish military effort that was guided and directed by the United States. So bureaucratically, the same building that housed the Special Forces Unit of the Turkish military that gave birth to these counter-guerrilla soldiers that were actually fighting Kurdish separatists and Turkish leftists and being used as an instrument of repression in Germany. You can actually sort of trace this group back to the CIA through its involvement with this particular unit of the Turkish military that was setting these things up. And it's an example, again, how a unit ostensibly set up in case of a Soviet invasion was actually used to intervene politically in Turkey. I mean, Italy also, there's some very tantalizing evidence, some hard and well-established links between stay-behind personnel in Italy, and that and the stay-behind operation was actually called Gladio. I'm sure you've talked about it on your program before. But there are a few instances in which people directly linked to Gladio are involved in acts of terrorism in Italy. There's really two or three hard and fast documented examples of that. Some people suggest that it was actually much more extensive and that much of the terrorism that scarred Italy in the beginning in the late 60s through the 70s into the early 80s was all part of a strategy of attention, that was orchestrated by Italian secret services and probably American secret services as well. That might be stretching it a bit based on the evidence that's actually known and established, but certainly certain acts involving the Gladio personnel are linked to terrorism.
You also write of the Greek Stay Behind contingent and some of their activities.
Yes, the Greek Stay Behind personnel were involved in the 1967 military coup that brought a repressive right-wing, some would say pro-fascist, junta to power in Greece, which stayed in power for several years. And Stay Behind personnel, again, that was supposed to be trained to thwart a Soviet invasion of Greece, if such a thing is even imaginable, in fact were utilized to intervene in Greek politics and basically smash the democratic structures of the cradle of democracy. That's what happened. And Greece is still suffering as a result of what happened there, even though now it's the Greek military junta has not been in power for several years, but still the country has never quite recovered.
And you mentioned that some of those Stay Behind people in Greece had also been active collaborators with the Nazi occupation.
Well, what happened there again is that this process whereby it came down to a choice. The British were particularly active in Greece during this period. When World War II was drawing to a close, there was a civil war that erupted in Greece between communists and right-wing reactionaries and fascists.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than support the resistance to Hitler, which was led by the communists, the British and ultimately the Americans sought to throw their weight behind the ultra-right-wing forces. Hence, many collaborators of Hitler benefited and were in Greece, were able to seize power. And the left was sort of kept on the ropes there for a long time.
There's a good book by Dominique Yudish called The Kapitanios, talking about the Greek resistance in World War II and what it led to in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Martin, this will probably be a very good place to terminate this half of the interview and turn over our tape.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Martin A. Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown, a vitally important recent book talking about the reemergence of fascism. For Martin Lee, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.